And labor to order, and I'm going to move the schedule around a little bit. I'm going to hear open a public hearing on House Bill 2944.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2944 is brought to you by a committee bill. It requires the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to determine upon request whether a proposed construction project is a public works project and when paying prevailing wage rates is required. And committee members, you have in front of you three sets of amendments. The dash one amendment is from the League of Oregon Cities. The dash six is from Metro. And the dash nine is from the informal work group. That's putting in some additional provisions to the measure. And you also have bullet points on what those amendments pertain in your staff measure summary, and also there's a one-page sheet on the dash nine amendment.
Okay.
Have you keep track.
All right, very good. I'm going to call David Fine, Randall Tosh, and Willie Tiffany. You call Dave and have him come on. Whenever one of you wants to get going, go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is David Fine. I'm city attorney of Baker City. I come to you here today to hope that you'll find relief for my community from what is perhaps the most absurd application of prevailing wage in the minds of most Oregonians that anyone would ever come across. In our city, we have a century-old Carnegie Library building which has not been used for years and years. The city has title to the building. The Crossroads Center for the Performing Arts proposed to raise about $2 million to convert this into a cultural center, a performing arts center, and a fine arts center. They've succeeded in raising all the money. Late in the day, out of the $2 million, they found that they could get a total of $30,000 by aggregating several small state grants. The amount of the state funding, therefore, is about 5% of the project, $40,000. The building is owned by the city. The city, under the lease, which is granting it to Carnegie, grants Carnegie the building for a term exceeding the useful life of the improvements Carnegie is obliged to make, and the city obliges itself to do certain structural maintenance on the building in perpetuity. Moreover, the lease can be made perpetual. Carnegie has unlimited rights of renewal. Carnegie Center for the Performing Arts in Baker City was astounded to receive a determination letter from the Bureau of Labor and Industry about a month or so ago, announcing to them that in view of this situation and the determination of that bureau, they're obliged to spend about 30% more on this project because 5% of the money they've received is state funding and because bare ownership of the building remains with the city. This is jeopardizing. The determination letter, of course, said this is a prevailing wage project. This determination letter has jeopardized the viability of a project essential to the cultural future of a small Oregon, rural Oregon community, and which we expect will play a very key part in the transformation of our largely timber-based economy, now defunct, into an arts and tourism economy. The project is literally ground to a halt out of the sense of fear which the Boldy determination letter instilled in the community group which is putting this project together. I would ask and hope that the members of this commission might find some relief for projects like this one, and in particular this project, in the context of the legislation which we're considering this session. Thank you.
And before we get going, I want to ask you a question. I understand from a good representative from Ontario that if we pass this bill, it will actually help you in that effort. Is that correct?
It might, sir, in two respects. It might prevent the situation from recurring again. However, there's no retrospectivity clause in the bill as I now read it. If that could be included, that might prevent the situation from going further. At a political level, it might be of some assistance to us, too, even without such a retrospectivity clause, in that it might make it all the more difficult politically for the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industry to uphold the determination in the opinion letter of a staffer.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, Willie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities, and House Bill 2944 was graciously introduced by this committee on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. We very much appreciate that.
Welcome.
We testified on House Bill 2557 about relationship between public agencies and the Bureau. with respect to public-private partnerships. However, this bill, 2944, seeks to also, in that testimony, we supported adding clarity to the law to avoid many of the lawsuits that we've seen over the past couple of years, and we believe that the intent of 2944 is to put some restrictions or at least incentives around predetermination so we get some of those answers right up front before we get into lengthy and costly litigation. With respect to the specific amendments, Mr. Chair, I did briefly, right before the committee, have a chance to look at the Dash 9 amendments, and with respect to the predetermination sections, we do agree. I did have a brief conversation with the commissioner, and he has graciously agreed to work with us, specifically on lines 8 and 9 on the first page. I think we have the same intent in mind, but in the spirit of agreement, we are going to go ahead and support the Dash 9 amendments with respect to the predetermination adjustments to 2944. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Tosh?
Okay, I'm Randall Tosh. I'm the city attorney for the city of Salem, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee. The city of Salem opposes any amendments to House Bill 2944 that would make Oregon's prevailing wage applicable to a privately owned construction project that is not used or occupied by a public agency. And we would wish to propose an amendment that would divide such projects into their public and private components and require the payment of prevailing wage on the public component only. The amendments that are before the committee are intended to expand the scope of Oregon's prevailing wage law in two ways. First, by requiring the payment of prevailing wage if a public agency will use or occupy 25% more or more of a privately owned building. And second, by requiring the payment of prevailing wage if $750,000 or more in public funds are used in the construction of a privately owned building. We believe that either change to Oregon's prevailing wage law is bad public policy, and there are two reasons. The first is that the amendments will prevent construction of projects that are good for Oregon's communities. And second, the amendments will decrease, rather than increase, the number of construction jobs that are created by public agencies in Oregon. The increased cost of prevailing wage that would result from these amendments will not be paid by the private developer. It will be paid by the public agency. Most, if not all, public-private partnerships have very narrow margins of financial feasibility. If the private developer has to pay the increased cost due to prevailing wage, the project will not pencil out. The private developer will then require new or increased public funds to construct the project. If the public agency has to provide the funds, the project will frequently not be built because the public agency has insufficient additional funds to pay the increased cost. Consequently, the application of prevailing wage to the private portions of a public-private partnership will defeat economic development by killing projects that bring both construction jobs and permanent jobs to Oregon. And let me give you an example. This has just occurred in the city of Salem. The Salem Urban Renewal Agency has been attempting to redevelop a five-acre parcel in North Salem. The agency solicited private developers to develop the site and selected a proposal that included the construction of 80 privately owned units of senior housing. Bowley determined, and the agency believes incorrectly, that the senior housing would be subject to prevailing wage because the agency was going to because the developer was going to receive a loan from the agency, and the development project resembled the agency's master plan for the five-acre site. As a result of the increased costs resulting from prevailing wage, the developer has determined that the entire project is not financially feasible. Therefore, the 80 units of senior housing will not be built. The construction of needed senior housing has been prevented, and the redevelopment of the site has been substantially delayed. If Oregon's prevailing wage law is changed to include privately owned projects that receive public funds, this will be a frequent occurrence, and the citizens of Oregon's communities will be deprived of needed and beneficial projects. We also would submit that the proposed amendments are bad public policy because they will eliminate rather than create jobs in the construction sector. Public funds are scarce, especially at the local level. And it is difficult for local governments to cobble together financial means to do any public work. If the public agency has to provide additional funds to cover the increased cost of prevailing wage, then this will limit the funds that are available for the construction of other public projects. The public funds that the proposed amendments will require are in effect a subsidy to private business and will result in public money paying for one privately owned project instead of two that benefit the general public. For instance, in downtown Salem, projects that could be used to pay for the amount of wages that the commissioner believes are should have been paid on the Phoenix Grand Hotel could be used for street resurfacing, Front Street off-ramps, safety improvements to parking structures, and the Union Street Railroad Bridge restoration, all prevailing wage projects. So what you do is you get one project rather than two. Now, we presented a proposed change to the definition of public work that would require the payment of prevailing wage on that part of a privately owned facility that will be used or occupied by the public, whether that percentage be 5% or 95%. We believe this is a fair and equitable solution to the issue. And in addition, the proposed definition would also eliminate the exemption for reconstruction or renovation of privately owned property that is leased by a public agency. This would be a change to the law. And we believe that the elimination of this exemption would be a direct and substantial benefit to the building trades. The largest public tenant in the state of Oregon, is the state of Oregon, which currently leases approximately 4 million square feet of space around the state for public use. This translates into 600 leases statewide. However, tenant improvements for these leased spaces are not subject to prevailing wage unless the improvements comprise 51% or more of the value of building or structure. In addition, if two or more state agencies are involved, these agencies' leases are not lumped together for the purposes of the agency's 51% rule. Therefore, a few tenant improvements for state agencies meet these thresholds, yet these improvements are undertaken to serve a substantial public purpose. Salem believes it's fair and equitable if an improvement that is constructed for use or occupation by the general public or public agency is subject to prevailing wage, even if that improvement is a leasehold improvement that comprises only a small part of the actual value of the building. So we, Salem would respectfully request that the committee reject any amendments to House Bill 2944 that would extend prevailing wage to privately owned and privately occupied projects, and would request that our proposed amendments be adopted. In addition, after having reviewed the proposed amendments that are before you, we think that you may also have a relating clause problem at this point because the changes are so substantial.
Thank you. Any questions of these gentlemen? Thanks. Thank you very much. Randy Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Randy Tucker, Metro Legislative Affairs Director. Just very briefly, you sat through my relatively lengthy testimony at the first hearing on House Bill 2557, which obviously this bill replaces. So I won't repeat Metro's concerns about the legislation, except to just briefly summarize that our concern has to do with a very small program of ours, a transit-oriented development program that supports projects in the centers that have been designated under Metro's 2040 growth concept, the region's long-range plan. And those projects are intended to accommodate as many as possible of the million people that we're expecting in the region in the next 25 years in vibrant centers in the communities throughout the region. And this the legislation, the Dash 9 amendments, I'm afraid, would dramatically undermine our ability to pursue that objective. I'm here in support of the Dash 1s or the Dash 6 amendments. The Dash 6 amendments are the ones that Metro submitted. The Dash 1s would also address our concerns. The bottom line is the projects that we participate in at a relatively low level in terms of the overall size of the projects, they end up with 0% public ownership and 0% public occupancy. So it's hard to understand how they could be considered public works under those circumstances. And the legislation before you, the Dash 9s, would basically make all of our major projects that we're involved with, again, they're not our projects, but we support them, into public works, where none of the projects we've worked on previously, the private projects, have been determined to be public works. I'll just stop there. You've got my amendment before you. It's the Dash 6. It would exempt a relatively narrow range of projects in specific geographic areas that have no public ownership or occupancy. And so thank you for the opportunity to offer that.
Thank you.
Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Andy? Thank you very much. Phil Donovan, and just Phil for now, please. And we'll fill up and hopefully finish.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, this is Cindy Cook, who is the Executive Director of Housing Works, a Housing Authority of Central Oregon. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Housing Authorities. We support the affordable housing exemption that is contained in the -9 amendments. And I want to start off by thanking the proponents of the legislation and the Bureau of Labor Industries. They all took considerable time and attention to understand the unique financial partnerships that come together to develop affordable housing in Oregon. And so what we see in the -9 amendments is that housing authorities, when they are involved in a partnership, limited liability company, or a nonprofit with private investment, are treated in a manner similar that treats the community development corporations that are currently in the bill. CDCs and housing authorities, as you know, are the two main developers of affordable housing in Oregon. We use the same financial tools to develop affordable housing for low-income Oregonians. And for the record, I think both on behalf of the community development corporations and housing authorities, you know, we want to point out that we are equally supportive of good wages and benefits as we are of building affordable housing. Neither entities are set up to be profit-driven. Neither entities are taxing authorities. Our interest is simply to help low-income Oregonians and working Oregonians. So by working together, what you have in the -9 amendments, frankly, eliminates the need for some other bills that we had introduced. House Bill 2824, which dealt with the expense of public works bonds. We don't need this if we get this done right. House Bill 3193, this would have been an exemption from prevailing wage on smaller projects defined as 12 units or less. We get this done right, we don't need that legislation either. And perhaps most importantly, by passing this legislation, we'll keep private investments coming into affordable housing in Oregon. So with that, we urge the adoption of the -9 amendments. And as I said, with me is Cindy Cook, Executive Director of Housing Works, an award-winning developer of affordable housing in Central Oregon, and she can help me with any technical questions you might have. Otherwise, we appreciate the time, Mr. Chair.
Did you want to testify, too?
No.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Donovan. Thanks for all the work you've done on this. I know at times it's been kind of difficult, but I appreciate your effort.
Thank you, sir.
Any questions of these fine people? All right. Thank you. John Jackley. How are you?
Good. Thank you very much. I'm John Jackley with the Portland Development Commission, and we wanted to take the opportunity to thank the committee and all the participants. We think a lot of progress has been made. We think this is generally headed in the right direction. We did have one concern this morning, but I had the opportunity to talk about it prior to the hearing with the Labor Commissioner, and that was the possibility that even in the -9s, that you could read some of the language that if you had a development agreement that was under $750,000 and didn't otherwise meet any of the tests, we were concerned that the wording could be interpreted to suggest that it would still be a contract for construction that was carried on by a public agency. But I did have the opportunity to talk to Commissioner Gardner, and he provided us with the reassurances that that would not be the case, and that was not the intent of the language. So we appreciate that very much. Just wanted to say that for the record. Also, we had a couple of minor details that can probably be fixed as the process unfolds. And then finally, our board asked me to pass on, of course, their concerns that we still need to look for opportunities to increase the access of women and minorities to these well-paying construction jobs, either through this bill or through some other vehicle. So I just wanted to say we appreciate the progress that's been made, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, as far as that concern, I think you can go back and tell your commission this committee is very interested in getting women and minorities in the construction field. I think I don't speak for all of them, but I'm fairly confident they all share that opinion. You can ask them yourself. But any questions or comments for Mr. Jackley? Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
All right, I have three more people on here. They're going to be the last panel, and they know who they are. Does anyone else want to testify to this that isn't signed up or sent me a note? Because this is it, last call. All right. Bob Shipwreck, Jessica Adamson, and Dan Gardner, please. Dan, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and let me just first address a couple of quick little things about some people who have testified before me's concerns. Mr. Fine with Baker City was concerned about the Carnegie Center. That really wouldn't fall under this particular bill in any way, shape, or form because it's city-owned property already. This is only privately owned property that these public-private partnerships address, so his problem is under regular prevailing wage law. You know, the one thing is this does provide very, very clear bright lines, and for people like Metro and others, they could donate up to $750,000 worth of public funds without triggering prevailing wage on these public-private partnerships. And I think this bill and these amendments culminate about 2.5-3 years, particularly of these two people's lives, who I've made co-chairs of a 8.5-month task force on this issue, and someday they promised me in a future life to forgive me for that. But this actually does clarify law. It does make that bright line, and I think it's a great move forward for both public entities, private development as well.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors to say that we do support the dash nines and the compromises that it contains. We think it went a long way to try and meet the needs of many parties, and commend Mr. Shipwreck for really working hard to try and make sure that as many interests as possible were accommodated, while again trying to maintain the whole idea of creating as clear and bright a line as possible, so that we know when projects are subject and when they are not subject to prevailing wage in these very complicated, very diverse situations. Also want to appreciate the commissioner for working with us to come to an understanding that when we talk about the 25% occupancy requirement, that we're talking about it at the time that the contract for construction is signed, as opposed to some point in the future while construction is underway, and it'd be very difficult at that point in time to go back and try and pay prevailing wage when prior to the start of construction there was not anticipated more than 25% occupancy. So we thank him for that, and again urge you to adopt the dash nines and move forward on this important issue this session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bob Shipwreck, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. You do have the one pager. I do not intend to walk through that. You've got it in front of you. It is a comprehensive examination of each section of the bill, addressing the concerns of various interest groups and the process that we've been through for 18 months now trying to fashion this piece of legislation. It is comprehensive. It is needed. We just can't keep fighting this issue out in court. I did want to make just a couple comments, very brief, about some of the things that were said by some other folks earlier. It kind of points to the frustration that I have over this whole issue, and people get pretty excited about things that, for instance, senior housing, unless it was four floors or over, would be under those Davis-Bacon rates, the senior housing in Salem. I shared with you what those rates are. I mean, some of them aren't even at the state minimum wage. They were established in 1979, so I hardly think you could build one rather than two projects with wage rates like that. Depending on the income level of that senior housing who it's built for, it might be, in fact, completely exempted from the rates. The problem that, I have met with the Metro folks, I would like to try and work out their concerns. I think I can demonstrate to them that their concerns are unfounded, but the problem goes to Randy's opening statement, where he said, this is our program. This is the transportation program that they have is theirs. So it's like, I think they're kind of carrying this construction on.
and it would only, their amendments were buildings, five floors, or actually it's five floors and above. That the building code changes, as some of you know on the committee, and they're talking about buildings built of concrete and reinforcing iron and or structural steel. So it's not stick frame. I'm going to compile a list. I started this morning going through my Dodge reports. I found two projects exactly that size in the Portland area. Both are being constructed by union contractors at union scale, so I don't know the concern. The last thing I'll say is they weren't available to be here today, but these amendments are also supported by the Oregon Bankers Association, who also wants clarity, and I have to add the all the affordable housing organizations throughout the state and in the city of Portland, the Community Development Network. So I'll stop, and if there's any questions, I'll try and answer them.
Any questions?
I am going to ask, when we move the amendment, I'm going to recognize someone. If that's the amendment I'm going to ask move. If one of the lawyers want to come on up and walk through those points briefly from the department, if that's okay with everyone, because I think we should go through them.
Okay.
One by one, just so no one can say we didn't, and just for the benefit of the committee as well.
I'd be happy to have them do that, Mr.
Any
Chair.
Questions, Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I haven't had a lot of time to look at these Dash 9 amendments. You know, one of the things that's always bugged me, and as probably Bob shares, is, you know, we're talking about wages, basically, in this. And this causes this big flap over, you know, we can't afford to do the project if we have to pay people prevailing wages. And, you know, it's hard for me to sit back and not say anything about that because, you know, it's those people that have good wages that keeps our economy going. But one of the parts that bothers me about this bill is, you know, we're asked looking for a bright line, and I commend everybody's worked on this to try to come up with a bright line to help in the litigation and everything. But, you know, the federal government and many states across this country have a bright line, and it's, you know, if you don't want to pay prevailing wages, don't use public funds.
Right.
End of story. And you know, right now I think if we use $50,000 worth of public funds, prevailing wage sets in. And in this particular bill, private public partnership or whatever title you want to give it can use $750,000 of public funds. And on top of that, have millions of dollars of tax breaks, tax incentives, which are basically, in my mind, public funds, which I had an amendment drafted to clarify those things as public funds as well. And, you know, to me, this is just a big loophole to use public funds without paying prevailing wages. And I'd like to see that bright line. That's the bright line I'd like to see. So I'm really struggling with supporting this bill because I think it goes the wrong direction. Was there a question there?
No, but I sure want to respond.
I can't disagree with a word you said.
Well, actually, I could respond. Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I mean, I can tell you, you absolutely are right. There are 31 other states in the nation that have a Prevailing Wage Act or a Little Davis-Bacon Act, and all 31 of them look at no difference between a public project and a public-private partnership. Eight of them, their threshold is $1. There are a number of others that have varying thresholds up to a maximum of $500,000. And this one is a threshold of $750,000 for public-private partnerships. It will be the highest threshold in the nation for public-private partnerships of the 32 states that have a Little Davis-Bacon Act.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, if I may, I think where AGC has, the reason why we spent so much time on this is because we look and we see kind of both sides of the issue. On the one hand, it is easy to say that when there is any public funds involved that you really have public participation, and should that at some level be subject, should the public have a right to say that there should be conditions on that development. And I would submit that even when they do give a grant, whether it's subject to prevailing wage or not, that there are conditions. It is going for some public benefit that is a good policy goal. Otherwise, the agency wouldn't be involved with it. But that aside, I think the reality as we look at it is we've got a law that is unique in that we have this two-part test that is very cloudy, it's very murky, it's been the source of a lot of litigation that we find counterproductive. It's a waste of public resources, quite frankly, with all due respect to the commissioner, it's a waste of public resources for both cities and for the state to be spending a great deal of money litigating these cases when those funds really could be used to build roads and bridges and sewers and things that we like to build. So creating a bright line that recognizes that in this scenario you're going to have things that because of that two-part test are going to come in that otherwise would have been exempt, and some things go out that might have otherwise been in, but on balance tries to create a line where we know the playing field, and I can't say because we don't know what the outcome of all of that litigation will be. It's hard to balance whether this brings more in or exempt more out. We wouldn't know unless we continued to litigate, and again, we see what that's cost the state thus far and what will continue to cost to continue to litigate, much less at the local government level to continue to litigate, and we find that unfortunate. Additionally, the loss of these development agreements because of the lack of certainty, we think, has cost construction jobs and other business opportunities because we don't have an answer. And to the extent that this provides an answer, even if it doesn't achieve all the policy goals we would like it to achieve, to the extent it provides an answer, it will create more jobs. It will create more development opportunities because there will be certainty. And again, I apologize for the long-winded answer, but we view that as an organization as a good thing so that we can stop the litigation and move forward with good development.
And I just want to respond to, in those eight states, I'm confident they're building bridges, confident they're building schools, hospitals, affordable housing, public-private partnerships. I'm absolutely confident. And those that say that these projects wouldn't happen are just, there's evidence there that they would. Any more for this nice panel? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2944, open a work session on House Bill 2944, Representative Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, I move the -9 amendments to House Bill 2944.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the -9 amendments into the House Bill 2944, and I'm going to ask either Christy or Doug to come up and just very quickly, I want you to keep in mind, Representative Smith is supposed to be in the governor's office right now. So let's, Representative Berger.
I would like to hear the -9s, and then I have a couple questions for you,
yes,
if you
ma'am.
Don't mind.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doug McKean. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Industries. I assume you'll need to go through the -9s and just talk about
those. You just want to go down this cheat sheet, Doug, if you have it.
I
you have that? Please. That's what we have before us, and I think it's a good tool for us to work on off of. Unless you got a better way, I'm open to suggestions. If you had it all prepared, Doug, go ahead.
I didn't. I was just going to sort of walk through the amendments. This might be faster.
All right. That's fine. Go ahead.
House Bill 2944, as you know, sections 1 and 2 would have created a predetermination process, so the Bureau would do predeterminations upon the request of a public agency or another interested person. The -9 amendments change the time frame within which the commission is supposed to do that from 15 days to 60 days. We had conversations with the Department of Justice. A lot of times the predeterminations come in, the Bureau does those and then sends those off to DOJ to get their review of it, and they just couldn't get it done within 15 days. So we increased that to 60 days. We also changed the process for getting judicial review of those. The bill has those going to circuit court for review of the commissioner's determination, and the amendments would make it so that there would be a contested case hearing within the agency, and the aggrieved person from that process, if they wanted to, could go to the Court of Appeals. So the normal judicial review of a contested case final order. So those are the amendments right at the top of page one of the dash nine amendments. If you move to pages 3 and 4 of the amendment, that's where the definition of a public works for all of the prevailing wage rate law is redefined. It keeps the current definition in what is now subsection 5A, large A, that's subparagraph A. So that hasn't changed, but there's some little language there deleted because that accommodates the new provisions, which are in subparagraphs B, beginning on page 3, and then on subparagraph C on page 4. And these are the two paragraphs that deal with the public-private partnerships. The first one, subparagraph B, deals with a situation where there's $750,000 or more of public funds in a project, and this is a project that's privately owned, uses funds of a private agency, but then also uses more than $750,000 of funds from a public agency. Subparagraph C is the same kind of public-private project. Again, it's privately owned. There's private, there's funds of a private agency. And in this paragraph, this is the one that talks about in which 25% or more of the square footage of the completed project will be occupied or used by a public agency. So there's the two new pieces of a public-private project, which would now, by definition, be considered public works.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hovey.
Thanks. I didn't mean to stop you right now. On big C, subparagraph little b there, public works does not include the reconstruction or renovation of privately owned property that is leased by a public agency. Is that currently, does our law consider that public works?
Right. If you turn back to page 3 of the amendment, on lines 26 and 27, that language was taken out there and now added as a new paragraph B.
And if I may on that, it's a privately owned piece of property. We're just renting it. They'd be using their own money to renovate it, I'd imagine. So that wouldn't trigger it. I don't know. Representative Holy.
Thanks for that follow-up. You almost got there for me.
Good.
So
doing better.
So a public agency then could put up the money for the reconstruction and renovation of private property, and it would not qualify as prevailing wage. Is that true? In other words, the state could run around remodeling private property and it would never trigger prevailing wage.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Would you like me to go ahead?
Yeah. Please.
On page 4 of the amendments, in a definition of funds of a public agency, and let me back up. Section 4 amends ORS 279C.810. This section in subsection 2 has those kinds of projects that are exempt from the public or the prevailing wage rate laws. Some of those kinds of projects are described by use of funds of a public agency. So there's a definition back up in sub 1 of funds of a public agency. There are two kinds of funds or sources of funds that are described. And you'll see in line 11 it says funds of a public agency does not include, and then down in subparagraphs C and D, which is new language, it talks about tax credits or tax abatements. This is just put into law what the Bureau is currently doing. We don't consider those funds of a public agency for purposes of the prevailing wage rate law. And likewise, when a public agency sells land to a private entity at fair market value, that's not considered funds of a public agency for purposes of deciding whether a project is exempt or not. If you turn to page 5, this is the language that's new and bold, starting at line 11. This is the flip side of the language I talked about a moment ago where it describes what a public works is and the public-private projects. This is the flip side saying that if a project is privately owned, uses funds of a privately private entity, uses less than 25% of the square footage of the completed project will be occupied or used by a public agency, and if there's less than $750,000 of funds of a public agency, then if all those conditions are met, these projects are exempt. They're not covered by the prevailing wage rate law. Paragraph D, which starts line 18, talks about projects for residential construction to provide affordable housing. This is the stuff that Phil Donovan talked about earlier. He described that both the housing authorities and the development corporations that do this kind of work. Do you want me to go into more detail about that?
You're doing great, Doug. I'm totally happy with you.
Perfect.
My facial expression has nothing to do with you.
You'll notice on page 6, starting on line 20 on down and then flowing over on page 7, subsection 3 has been deleted. And what this talks about are projects that are divided by a public agency and when it's unlawful for a public agency to divide a project to try to avoid paying prevailing wages. This language is not really being repealed from the law. It's simply being deleted here, and it's recreated in the new Section 8. So it's simply being moved to a new section because we're adding new language talking about when the commissioner should divide up a project, and all of that new language is in new Section 8. So we're trying to keep all of that language about dividing up projects into the public parts and the private parts all together in one section. This is more of an organizational issue just to try to keep this stuff clear, keep it clear, and also to leave then in Section 4, which again means 279C.810, that section will then be exclusively dealing with exemptions from public works. Or exemptions from the prevailing wage rate law. What you're going to see on page 7, amending 279C.815, is what looks like new language in paragraph B. Actually, this is all existing language that is being moved out of the earlier section, Section 3 of the bill. Unfortunately, in the current law, in the definition of prevailing rate of wage, the first sentence defines what that term means. The next several sentences don't define the term at all, but really tell the commissioner how to do those determinations. That kind of substantive material should not be stuck in the middle of a definition. So this bill presented an opportunity to do a little law improvement project and take that language out of the definition and simply move it into the correct section, which is in Section 5, amending 279C.815. And that whole section deals with the commissioner making those determinations of what are prevailing wages. And so it simply moves that language, and that's the only reason Section 5 is in the bill. I'm moving on to page 8, Section 6, which amends 279C.830. This section, for the most part, talks about the specifications that have to be in a public works contract, the specifications for the prevailing wages. You'll see in line 23, subsection 1A now has some new language starting off, except as provided in paragraph D of this subsection. We put that language there because the normal rule for public agencies, including the specifications in their advertisements for a public project, don't work very well, they don't work at all, for these public-private projects. The new paragraph D on page 9 is new language that's designed to address the kinds of agreements that are reached between public agencies and private entities when they do these public-private projects. It specifies which prevailing wage rates apply to those projects, and then in the second sentence on lines 14 through 16, it says that the specifications for any contract for the public works shall include the applicable prevailing rate of wage. It's simply trying to make the law fit with the kinds of agreements that we're talking about in these public-private projects.
You're doing great.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
On page 10, section 7 says that sections 8 and 9 are added to the series of laws that deal with prevailing wage rates. Section 8 is the section I mentioned a while ago. Subsection 1A, I think all of subsection 1 is that language we moved out of the other section and into this section to simply preserve it. But it deals with, again, it's a prohibition on public agencies from dividing up a project illegally in order to avoid paying the prevailing wage. If you look in paragraph C, beginning on line 16, it then lists the criteria the commission is supposed to look at in determining whether a project has been properly or improperly divided up. The new subsection 2 on page 10 and subsection 3 on page 11 then describe circumstances in which you have one of these public-private projects, and there are circumstances under which the folks who put this together determined it would be appropriate for the commissioner to divide up a project and carve up those parts that are purely private and not require prevailing wage rates on those parts of the project from those parts of the project that are either going to be occupied by the public agency or the part of the project for which the public funds are being used. So again, using those same criteria that you saw back up in subsection 1, the commissioner now is being required to look at some of these public-private projects and decide when it's appropriate to carve them up and decide which parts of the project should not have to have prevailing wage rates paid on those parts. Section 9 gives express authority to the commissioner to adopt rules to deal with the prevailing wage rates law. The commissioner already has authority in ORS Chapter 651 in 060 subsection 4 to adopt rules for any laws of which the commissioner has authority. This simply puts a express statutory authority within the same series that the prevailing wage rates are to say, commissioner, you shall adopt rules. The commissioner is already adopting rules. This is just making it easier for everyone to understand his statutory authority. Section 10 on page 11 is an applicability provision, making it clear that these new changes are not going to apply to any public works contracts that were entered into before these laws become effective. Subsection 2 is likewise. These changes in the law are not going to apply to agreements entered into by certain urban and rural agencies. Their development and disposition agreements that were entered into before or signed before the effective date of this act. These kind of applicability provisions are especially important here because Oregon Constitution says that the legislature may not adopt a law that interferes the obligations of contracts. So we don't want to have these laws go back and interfere with contracts that have already been entered into for these sorts of projects. Section 11 is an emergency clause, and so the bill and all these amendments would be effective on July 1st, 2007. I think there was widespread agreement that, assuming this is all a good thing, we should get it into place as soon as possible so that we don't have to continue the fights that we've had in the past.
I couldn't agree more, Mr. McKean, but I do, and this is why we have the committee process, because we have several heads working on it. I want someone that can hopefully tell me why, on page 4, lines 7 and 8, we're not including, we would, under what circumstances, and why would we not trigger prevailing wage if we're using government money to reconstruct or renovate privately owned property that is leased by a public agency. Can someone explain the logic of why we, Christy, if you want to come up and do it for him, why we don't do that? Because I think there's some concern up here about that.
All I can tell you is that language, if you look again back on page 3, lines 26 and 27, mm-hmm. This just duplicates that provision. That language has been in here for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is, and it's only a guess because I haven't researched it, but there was a case called, it had to do with the Oregon Public Broadcasting years ago when they were having a building built out of McAdam Avenue in Portland, and it was a private building on private land, and they were going to lease it. And that case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, that's not a public works project.
So we don't do a lot of that then. Is that the answer? We don't do a lot of that now. Okay. Any more questions for Mr. McKean? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. McKean. Would you have page 4, line 25? It makes a reference to a statutory definition of nonprofit organization. Do you know if there's a reference in this? I mean, why? What is that referring to? Is nonprofit somewhere in here that I've been looking for it and where it applies?
Yes.
And I'm sorry, Mr. McKean, Mr. Chair, if you'll pardon me. This is my first look at these dash 9, so I was looking furiously for any particular reason why that was in there, and I couldn't find it. I wondered if you could help me.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if you look back up on lines 12 and 13, again, this is the definition of funds of a public agency, and it's talking about if funds are provided in the form of a government grant to a nonprofit.
Okay, so... So it's in other words, if a government grants to a nonprofit under 501(c), it would not be included as a under prevailing wage.
That's correct, unless the nonprofit is specifically using those funds for construction, reconstruction, renovation, and so on. You see that language on line 14. And really, this isn't new, particularly that definition of nonprofit and the definition of funds of a public agency. That's language that has been in here for two or three sessions, and a lot of that sprang out of the Salem Carousel project when a nonprofit was building the carousel, and there was a question about whether that was a public works job. And so this language
So under this language, that would definitely be a public works job.
It could be. It's just in terms of what funds of a public agency does not include, it does not include a grant to a nonprofit unless the grant is issued for the purpose of construction, reconstruction, major renovation, or painting.
Or putting a new roof on with volunteer labor, for instance.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Gardner, please come forward if you can add some clarity.
Representative Berger. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Last session, Representative Berger, we adopted language that allowed for donated lumber or donated labor not to be included in that of public funds. And that has always been the interpretation of the Bureau, is that donated materials and donated labor do not count.
Okay.
Any further questions? All right. Hang on.
Nope. Those are the only ones I had question marks.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there any further discussion or comments on the dash nines?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
It seems to me that the dash nines look an awful lot like the language in House Bill 2557. Are they not?
Yes, it does.
It also has been detailed to me in the last 5 minutes that there was an informal work group on this bill, which I believe is the first time we've heard this bill, isn't it, Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So at some point, an informal work group was put together who put together, quite a few amendments since we're on Dash 9, and this is the first time we've ever heard this. I'm just curious to know who was on that informal work group, Mr. Chair.
It was me, Building Trades, Boley, I believe the contractors, Affordable Housing, and everyone was invited, and they're nodding their head.
And this group met how frequently in the last couple?
We met this morning.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted that on the record. Clearly, we also have testimony that there's over 18 months work on this thing. I don't know why we're switching to another bill, Mr. Chair, why we didn't run the first one in the first place.
Because if we wanted to change the definition of public works, it didn't fit underneath the relating clause of 2557. That's why.
I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other further discussion, comments, questions? Is there any objection to the Dash 9s?
I don't like the Dash 9s, Mr. Chair.
All right, then, Kristen, call the roll, please.
Aye.
No.
Vice Chair
Esquivel.
Excuse.
Vice
Chair Holby.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
So moved. Representative Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2944 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 2944 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Can I speak to the bill, Mr.
Representative
Chair?
Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can see I stand alone. Everyone seems to have been at this work group but me, and I just saw these Dash 9 amendments today. I would call your attention to page 10 of the Dash 9s and sections 8 and probably 9. These are what I would call the Salem Conference Center amendments that basically mean that in the future there will be no projects like the Salem Conference Center, which was highly contested and litigated. Speaking of, we had a lot of discussion about litigation, but of course Salem won that litigation, and the Salem Conference Center goes forward. There won't be any more projects like that by my reading of that section if we make this statutory. I agree there has been way too much litigation, but I also think that litigation is the only way left when a bureaucracy dictates outside of their purview, and I think that that has happened in this instance. I also think that we are going to see a lot of really good projects die if this continues this kind of statutory language, and it's really unfortunate. It's going to make some of the more creative and good ways to get things done be stopped. And I understand Representative Holby's understanding that, you know, the only good project is one that pays the full bore. But I would like it noted that private entities want to help government and they want to invest in government. But putting more roadblocks to it doesn't help either government or private entities. I absolutely think a bright line is a good idea, but not this bright line, not this bill. I'm opposed to it, and I will vote no. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion or comments? Kristen, call the roll, please.
Aye.
No.
Excused.
I'm voting no, but I'm going to reserve the right to change my vote on the floor, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You, Representative.
I'll vote yes, but I reserve my right to vote no on the floor.
Thank you.
Aye.
We all have our right to change our mind anytime we want, but I vote aye, and I'm confident I will not be changing mine. I will carry
Mr. Chair,
Representative Berger.
And notice of possible minority report.
Thank you very much. I will be carrying this bill on the floor.
Who else
voted
no?
All right. I'm going to close the work session of House Bill 2944. I'm going to open a House Bill, a work session of House Bill 2070.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2070 was pre-session filed at the request of the Employment Relations Board, and we had the first hearing on this measure on January 22nd. It increases the current fee from $100 to $250 to file an answer with the Employment Relations Board in regards to unfair labor practice proceedings under the public employee collective bargaining laws. It also establishes a fee of $250 to file charges or an answer with the board in other unfair labor practice proceedings and to intervene in unfair proceedings. And there's an emergency clause and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Do I have a sign-up sheet on this?
No. It's a work session, Mr. Chair, so.
Oh, well, okay, great. I'll entertain a motion. Representative Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2070 to Ways and Means with be sent to Ways and Means without recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum, after a long time, the chair's held this up here because he's an obstinate mule, moves House Bill 2070 to Ways and Means without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that I am really disturbed by the state of affairs over the funding situation at the Employment Relations Board. It came as quite a surprise to me to learn in the course of testimony on this bill that unrepresented workers who have unfair labor practices are forced to pay fees in order to have those charges heard. And I think it's not the right way to go about funding this agency. It's not the way we do it in the private sector. I think it is really unfair, but apparently right now it's the only way to continue to fund the agency, and I gather that this bill is assumed in the budget that is already under consideration or perhaps even passed out of Ways and Means, so I think we need to send it on.
Any further? Thank you, Representative. And I share your concerns, I assure you. Any further discussion or comments about this bill? All right, thank you. Kristen, would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Edwards. Aye.
Representative
Gregory.
Aye.
Vice Chair Escobar.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. All right, then. It's going to move to Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2070. I'm going to open work session on House Bill 2486.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2486 is a Business and Labor Committee bill on behalf of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. We had the first hearing on this measure on February 19th. The measure permits the surety bond that wineries must currently provide to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to cover unpaid tonnage tax in addition to covering unpaid wine taxes as currently established in statute. It also creates a discretionary exception to the surety bond requirement for small wineries that are eligible for the small production exemption from wine privilege taxes. And there's no amendment in front of you.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holby.
I move House Bill 2486 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Holby moves House Bill 2486 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? All right. Kristen, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to volunteer for this?
Love to, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Holby will carry it. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2486 and open the work session on House Bill 2487.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2486 is a Business and Labor Committee bill on behalf of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. We also first heard this bill on February 19th. It clarifies current statutes reflect that a wine warehouse can provide full service to persons that hold a grower sales privilege license or a wholesale malt beverage and wine license.
And Teresa, just so I know, this and the one just before this, all the proponents and everyone has shared any concern in the department are all happy in the valley over these two bills.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And unfortunately, there's no one here.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The representative from the Wine Growers Association is at another hearing. So.
Yeah, okay. All right. I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move House Bill 2487 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger, in the most cooperative fashion, moves House Bill 2487 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right. Kristen, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Any minority reports on this one?
Mr. Okay. Chair, no minority reports.
Anyone like to volunteer? Representative Berger, would you like to carry this great
delighted
bill on the floor? Thank you. All right. So moved. I'm going to close work session on House Bill 2487 and open work session on House Bill 2074.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2074 was pre-session filed to request the Landscape Contractors Board. We had hearings for this bill on January 17th and February 14th. It requires a landscaping business license applicants to have at least one owner licensed as a landscape contractor or have the managing owner complete courses and pass an examination required by the Landscape Contractors Board. And you have in front of you a dash one amendment that was drafted out of concerns from the committee in the previous hearings. The amendment essentially does is defines a managing employee and an owner, and that either the managing employee or the owner must provide proof to the board that they have completed the required courses outlined in the measure and passed the relating examination. And we do have Mike Snyder from the board here available to answer any questions.
And if I remember right, it was the hang-up on the managing owner.
Yes.
And if there was a managing employee allowed to go, we're going to be okay. Am I correct?
Yeah,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
All right. Is there any other further discussion on this? I'll entertain a motion if not.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2074.
Representative Holby moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2074. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Any objection? All right, so all right, Representative Holby.
Chair, I move House Bill 2074 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Holby moves House Bill 2074 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Representative
Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Holby.
Aye.
Captain Smith.
Excuse?
Vice
Aye. Aye. Representative Berger, would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
To.
Thank you very much. So moved. I'm going to close work session on House Bill 2074 and open work session on Senate Bill 197A.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 197A was pre-session filed at the request of the Employment Department. We had a hearing on the measure on March 23rd. It rewrites the Employment Department's authorization for disclosing confidential information to other agencies, allows increased access to aggregate information about industries, and also clarifies that disclosure to the U.S. Attorney's Office can be made in response to a federal grand jury subpoena. And there are no amendments in front of you.
All right. Any questions on this bill? Any concerns? Any discussion? I'll entertain a motion.
Hold on just a second. I was still catching
197. You're on.
Thank you.
Okay. We're not in a hurry.
No.
And Mr. Chair, we do have representatives. Okay. We do have Tom Barley from the Employment Department.
Are there any questions on this bill?
No.
Representative Edwards, you okay?
Yep.
Representative Berger?
Yeah, I was just catching up.
All right, I'll entertain a motion.
Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move Senate Bill 197A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 197A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Kristen, please.
Representative
Edwards.
Aye.
Representative
Berger.
Aye.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Holby.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Excuse.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Aye. Can I get a volunteer to carry this, or?
I'll carry it, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Berger. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 197A. And I just want to say, I know that prevailing wage bill, I want this on the record, too, is very hard for some of us. But I think this committee is showing that we can work together in a civil fashion, even when we do disagree, and that's what we're here to do. So I just want to thank the entire committee.
May I make a comment, Mr.
Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, we are here to do policy, and disagreements arise around policies. There is never anything personal in it.
I couldn't agree more. I second that. All right. Anything else for the good of the order? All right. We're adjourned.